This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer studio once boasted that it had more stars than heaven. They produced many of the now classic films like Gone with the Wind, The Wizard of Oz, and Singing in the Rain. Today the studio sits in limbo, its planned sale is entangled in a lawsuit, and its stock price is falling. My guest Peter Bart has chronicled the current era of the MGM studio in the book Fade Out, The Calamitous Final Days of MGM. Peter Bart spent more than 20 years in the film industry. He was a vice president of production at Paramount, where he oversaw the production of Rosemary's Baby, The Conversation, Goodbye Columbus, Harold and Maude, and The Godfather. He was the president of the Lorimar Film Company, then went to MGM, where he was a senior vice president of production. Bart is now the editor of Variety. While at MGM in the early 80s, Bart worked under the leadership of Kirk Kerkorian. Kerkorian bought MGM in 1969 and has presided over the disintegration of the studio. Peter Bart is critical of Kerkorian and says that he transformed corporate demolition into a high art. I asked Peter Bart if the story of MGM is typical of Hollywood now, or if it's a singular tale.
It's a singular tale. Of course, other studios have been taken over by multinationals. Sony bought Columbia last year, and the studios are no longer just movie-making entities as they were a couple of generations ago. But MGM and its sister company, United Artists, both of them illustrious old film companies with long histories, the fact that they were taken over and to a degree vandalized is the most extreme example in the film industry.
What's different about the MGM story and how it was taken over as compared to how the other film studios were taken over by multinationals?
Well, when Gulf and Western took over Paramount, for example, and I joined Paramount shortly thereafter, there was the desire of Gulf and Western and its own inventor, a man named Charles Bludon, to build a movie company. I mean, he felt that in the movie industry and in its ancillary industries, such as video and television and in the international market and so forth, in that industry lay the opportunity for great growth. So he was there to build, just as Lou Wasserman took over MCA to build it. Sony, I think, genuinely wants to build Columbia. Kerkorian, however, was more of a wheeler dealer, a trader. His background was Las Vegas, and he started early on to strip assets of the company. It began to be clear early on that he was not a builder; he was a trader.
So when Kirk Kerkorian took over MGM, he slowly started selling off a lot of what made MGM MGM: the library, the back lot, the costumes. What was his rationale for doing it?
Well, what he was straight away very candid about his desire to build an empire in Las Vegas and in Reno, Nevada. So he simply explained, "I'm using these resources to open up my other ventures." He believed in the future in Las Vegas and quite correctly so. He also contended, as did his then president Jim Aubrey, that it was possible to run a movie company, not by spending outrageous sums of money to make and promote films, but that you could make very successful pictures on the cheap. So the pictures he set out to make cost $1.5 million, $2 million. When you consider that his entire program of pictures for several years cost under $3 or $4 million, in the context of today's films, which cost $75 and $80 million, the degree of self-delusion was extraordinary.
So the profits that Kerkorian made selling off the MGM backlot and library and so on was used to make other deals as opposed to having the money put back into MGM?
Until about 79 or 80, when Kerkorian began to realize the extraordinary growth of the entertainment industry, became impressed by the same phenomena I mentioned earlier, by video and by television and by the international potential of the business. And it was at that time that he bought United Artists, which had been started decades earlier by Charlie Chaplin and Murray Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., and then began to pour vast sums of money into these two companies he wanted at that time to build. He felt the movie industry could could be a big winner for him. And it started sort of the second decade of his of Kerkorian's life at MGM, where he was spending vast sums of money and appointing one management team after another, none of whom had any success whatsoever in establishing themselves at the company.
Peter Bart, you joined MGM in 1983. You were a senior vice president of production at MGM. What got you to join?
Well, I felt, to a degree, I was a sucker for the MGM legend. I thought this was the studio with the greatest history, the greatest tradition. And even though it had had lean times, I was conceited enough to think that maybe I could participate in some small way to turning it around. Also, the man who was the COO, the chief operating officer of the company at the time, I had worked for at Paramount. And we had had great success there, making some good pictures, such as The Godfather and so on. So I had hoped that maybe we could replicate the success of a decade earlier. I was wrong.
Some of the movies that you oversaw in your days at MGM include Mrs. Sofel, 2010, and Red Dawn. None of those were commercial successes. Were these movies that you wanted to make?
They were. I thought each had a chance if they were made correctly. I mean, Red Dawn was supposed to be a relatively low-budget picture. And mind you, the Cold War was still going on in this time. This was several years ago. And the idea of the picture was to show what would happen if the United States had been invaded successfully by Russians and Cubans. It was an interesting script written by Kevin Reynolds showing how the shock of America being invaded. Now, what happened was that over a period of weeks, the picture got a massive infusion of ideas from all kinds of unexpected sources. General Alexander Haig, former chief of staff and briefly the Secretary of State, he was a director of MGM, and he had all kinds of, he felt, brilliant ideas about this picture. The film, over a period of weeks and months, turned from a small, low-budget picture into a massive, expensive shoot-'em-up, which didn't really make any point whatsoever. So you had a case where the meaning of a picture was totally subverted, and the values that attracted us all to it had disappeared.
My guest is Peter Bart, and he has a new book on the demise of the MGM UA studio. It's called Fade Out. He was a senior vice president at MGM, and he's now the editor of Variety. I'd like to get back to something we were talking about a little earlier, and that's how under Kerkorian, MGM sold off a lot of its assets, including its own library. MGM sold its library of films to Ted Turner. And this was in what year?
This was in, I believe, 84 or 5. And what Turner was a subject of great derision in Hollywood because he came in and said that he was agreed to buy the company for about $1.3 billion. Everyone felt he was this yahoo from Georgia who had gotten taken by Kerkorian. But after he closed the deal, he started his own Kerkorian-like a series of renegotiations. And he kept on changing the deal and studying the deal and changing it again and renegotiating it. Finally, what happened was that he ended up spending a lot less than $1.3 billion and ended up with this enormous library of old MGM films. And what no one knew, except Turner, was that the reason he wanted these films was that he was going to start a new channel, TNT, and needed these films to be the basis of this new service. As it turned out, Turner had the last laugh because TNT went on to be an enormous success. And indeed, Turner, I think, will be the great media hero of the 90s. But he was the one, in this particular case, who took Kerkorian to the cleaners, rather than vice versa.
How much of the film library did he get? What years did he get?
He got all of the great old MGM films going back to the Garbo pictures and Gone with the Wind and so forth, which for a Southern boy was a great treat, right up to those of the early 80s. So he got some great movies. He did not get, of course, the UA pictures like the Bond pictures and the Pink Panther pictures and the Rocky pictures. Those are now in play in yet another series of abstruse negotiations that have just blown up, in which Kerkorian yet again recycled his woebegone company to an Italian entrepreneur named Peretti. And Peretti managed to elicit the support of Warner Brothers, who helped arrange a $650 million loan, which would enable Peretti and his company, Pathé, to buy MGM UA. The problem is that Warner's got into a fight with Peretti and not only withdrew from the negotiations, but are suing him for $100 million. And Peretti is now having to look elsewhere for the financing, if he can find it, to buy MGM. So where MGM ends up today is in the doldrums. It's frozen, doesn't have enough money to make pictures. It's sitting there, sort of the dead duck of the entertainment business.
Well, Kerkorian has been trying to sell MGM for about 2 years now. Why has he been trying so hard to sell the company?
Well, I think Kirk, now in his early 70s, has finally come to terms with the fact that whatever he did try to do for MGM, he ended up really doing to it. That he just doesn't have the touch to succeed in the film business, and he wants to get out at the best possible price. Now, by cycling and recycling the assets of this company, he's already made about $1 billion over the past 4 years. So he has turned out fine. The thing is that Leo the Lion is twisting in the wind.
Leo the Lion is the logo. Well, one last question about MGM. What's the moral of the story for the rest of the movie industry?
Well, I think the moral of the story, in part, is twofold. First, if you're going to take on a company, as Kerkorian did 20 years ago, you've got to do it from the point of view of a builder and not a trader. Otherwise, you may make some bucks, but you're going to end up with a disaster on your hands. And I think the second thing is that the business still runs on trust, that once that confidence between the filmmakers, the artists, and on the one hand, and the executives who run the company on the other hand, once that trust is destroyed, you end up in a curious downward spiral, and nothing can reverse it.
I can't let you go without hearing a few good Godfather stories. The Godfather is one of the movies that you worked with when you were a vice president for production at Paramount. So I don't know where to begin on.
Well, Godfather was a weird experience because basically I had bought a 60-page manuscript, and basically no one else at the studio thought it was a good idea. Recent mafia pictures have been a total failure. But when the book was finished and before it was published, the studio offered it to maybe 20 directors, and everyone turned it down, either on the grounds that mafia pictures don't work or on the contention that that this glamorized the mafia. And I finally approached Francis Coppola, who had then done Finian's Rainbow, which is not exactly a good preparation. Just because I felt that he had a great take on the movie. He felt you should tell the story as it was told, as a family chronicle, not necessarily just as a mafia story. And it was Coppola who rounded up this extraordinary, at that time, very untried cast of characters, Jimmy Kahn, Al Pacino, Diane Keaton, and so forth. When Bob Evans, who was head of the studio, and who really was rather bored by this whole endeavor, suddenly saw the lineup of actors, he was totally appalled. I mean, he said, Al Pacino? Who is Al Pacino? Who's that little Italian dwarf you're going to put him in this movie? And he basically fired the whole cast and made Francis take a month off and start shooting tests of a whole new cast of characters. At the end of those tests, Evans threw up his hands and said, well, you were right, I was wrong, let's go with the dwarf, go with the other dwarves, do it any way you want, just, you know, include me out, as he and the picture sort of got made against the wishes of essentially everybody at the studio.
Did you ever have to take a director off of a film?
Oh, yeah, on many occasions.
Who did you take off?
Well, we were in pre-production and rehearsal on a picture called The Pope of Greenwich Village at MGM, where the director in question was just, he was losing the loyalty of his actors, and also was changing his mind incessantly about about the cast, and was generally not inspiring confidence. But it's always an unpleasant experience to fire a director. And one of the great nightmares of the filmmaking process is to fire a director in midstream.
Did you ever have to do that in midstream?
Yes, I did. It was one of the great nightmares.
What movie was it?
You never get away easy. Well, I shouldn't talk about that, because sometimes you get a person who's going through a bad time, whose marriage is breaking up, who's having an affair with his star, or who's having a fight with a star, or is competing with the affections for one of the people in the cast. You have any number of unexpected things that occur. So it is a sort of sordid and unpleasant experience when you go in and have to say to somebody, you know, it's all over. I mean, I've been gone to a set of a movie where there was cocaine abuse, and given a star aside in his trailer and said, look, you are abusing cocaine. You are essentially incoherent. I will guarantee you that I will see to it that by notifying the insurance companies, you will never, ever be insurable in the movie business again. So you have one day to shape up, or you're a has-been. And the actor, in this case, responded in his usual lovable way. He said that he would arrange to have me killed within the next 24 hours.
So what happened?
He never used cocaine again on any picture, and I survived.
That's an interesting way to threaten someone, that you're going to tell the insurance company and they won't be insurable anymore.
Well, you know, it's high budget pictures. The insurance guys have the big cards, because on many co-productions, for example, you need a completion bond, and between the insurance people and the completion bond people, actors, stars, and directors who are become problematic, their careers are in serious jeopardy.
What's a completion bond?
Well, a completion bond is something that I was the company that was putting up half the money for a picture, and some Europeans were putting up the other half, before my money would flow, someone would have to buy a bond where if the picture was never delivered to me, the money would nonetheless be paid. The money that I had advanced toward the picture would be repaid me. It was just an insurance policy that a picture will be delivered in a professional way.
So what does an actor get insured for?
He gets insured during the course of production, if he gets sick or has a heart attack or has a seizure due to drug abuse, that the studio gets paid. There have been cases where $10 million was invested in a picture, and an actor became ill or had a heart attack, and that money is paid the studio by the insurance company. It's a hairy business.
Yeah, I can see that.
And then the sad case is you get great directors who, as they get older, like David Lean, are not insurable anymore. I mean, David Lean, for example, he's just about to start a new picture at the age of 81. But in order to get a completion bond that covered him, another director had to be hired who would be on the set all the time and be paid $1 million, so that if Lean became physically impaired, this other director would step in immediately, and not even a day would be lost. That's when the bonding business gets difficult.
Why are you out of movies now?
Well, I devoted 20 years to the movie business, and I loved it and still do. But basically, the film business today consists of the process of mobilizing 50, 60, 70 million dollar action pictures, Arnold Schwarzenegger pictures, Dick Tracy pictures, and hoping to hit that blockbuster for the summer market. To me, whereas making commercial pictures was always important, as I mentioned before, the challenge of the business also was trying to marshal those unexpected pictures, the pictures like Being There, which I fostered when I was at Lorimar, to make the pictures that no one felt was a sure thing, but offered a different point of view toward the film business. In this industry as it is today, the way it's constructed now, it's almost impossible to function that way at a studio. So I frankly prefer to do what I started out doing, and that's journalism.
Yeah, you're the editor of Variety. Is there an era you would most like to have made movies in?
You know, I think that I was lucky. I think the most that ultimately people are going to look back on the 66 to 76 period as a golden age of filmmaking, because styles were changing so fast. Every time you went to the movies, you were sort of in awe of what you saw, whether it was 2001 or Easy Rider or Bonnie and Clyde. I mean, every picture seemed to sound different and look different. It was an extraordinary period of change. And I think that I was lucky enough to be around at the best of times, which later became the worst of times.
Peter Bart, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
My guest has been Peter Bart, and his new book is called Fade Out, The Calamitous Final Days of MGM. He's a former vice president in MGM, a former vice president of Paramount, and he's now the editor of Variety. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.